I mean, once you have job descriptions and rules and regulations and KPIs and targets and all that kind of thing, you have specifically stopped people being creative.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturesson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Arts Management. Willful blindness. It's a phrase that encapsulates so many of the issues we face in the world of business and government and nonprofit sector today. There were things we should have known but chose not to see, things we knew but decided to ignore. Whether in unhealthy or toxic culture, corporate scandals, accidents, or an inability to adapt, willful blindness leads to tragic consequences time and time again. Margaret Heffernan has studied the reasons and consequences behind willful blindness. It's a theme that runs through several of her books, most notably Willful Blindness, Why We Ignore the Obvious at Our Peril, and her great TED Talk on the same subject. As we are facing a time of great turmoil and uncertainty, our team wanted to bring back a conversation I had with Margaret at the beginning of 2021. We discussed how willful blindness hinders us from mapping the future and leads to ethical blindness. While the COVID-19 pandemic is not as top of mind as it was 2 years ago, the challenge of willful blindness is the same. As Margaret says in the conversation, the question we should ask ourselves is how come so many people knew, but no one said anything? Margaret Heffernan is a professor, author, and former serial entrepreneur and CEO. And I hope you will find our conversation as helpful, insightful, and impactful as I did. But now, without further ado, let's jump into my 2021 conversation with the great Margaret Heffernan. So we were supposed to have this interview at the beginning of December last year. However, I got sick and I had to reschedule, but now I'm actually really thrilled that we get to have this conversation at the onset of 2021, since I can't really think of a better person to talk to when it comes to how we as leaders, as professionals, can think about entering a new year. And we're going to talk more about that from an organizational perspective. But first, I just wanted to ask you, from a more personal perspective, it is a special year, and it's been a very special year. Do you have any personal practices as a leader that help you think about and prepare for a new year?
I do take some time every year to sit down with my husband and go through what we hope to achieve in the year. And this is much more qualitative than quantitative, but, you know, we review our finances to see, are we okay? What, you know, what can we afford? What can we not afford? We think about what we want to achieve professionally. We think about, you know, the quality of our family life, the quality of our social life, how healthy we are physically, and whether there's any big change of any kind that we might want to make in our life. So it's pretty well-rounded. It's absolutely not about metrics and targets and goals and all that kind of stuff, but it is kind of taking that rather peaceful time between Christmas and New Year to just think about what has the year been like. What would we like to change? What would we like to do more of? What would we like to do less of? And it's kind of interesting because we often do have particular aims in mind, but having discussed them between ourselves, we then, you know, we don't manage ourselves by KPIs. But we often, when we look back the next year, we realize, well, either, you know, we did or we didn't achieve the goals we set out to. achieve. And for the most part, we generally have, which is kind of satisfying. And I think speaks to the desire, to the degree to which, if you think about and articulate what it is you're aiming at, you're much more likely to get there, even without any rigorous kind of oversight or management. So yeah, we definitely do that.
And I'm thinking that that has been perhaps, I mean, I found that myself and for our family, that it's been feeling even more important at the end of 2020 and to do that, to have that type of practices and to take that time to reflect. Have you found the same?
Well, I've always found it really important, and not least because I think it's very easy to just do what your boss says or just do what your inbox says. And I'm someone who quite likes change, and I obviously change my career quite often, but I don't do it, you know, I don't do it just because I get bored. You know, I try to do it pretty thoughtfully. So I think you can't really do that if you don't carve out some time to do it. I also think that, you know, we all receive a lot of impressions every day, every month, every year, and we quite often waste them by not thinking, what do they mean? So, for example, I made a very decisive shift out of television because I felt that that time, which was the early 90s, you know, there was going to be a lot of demand for more television, but not very much more money, and that therefore it would become a pretty sleazy business. Which turned out to be true. And so, you know, that I had to make quite a decisive attempt to change direction. And I can't think of any other way of doing that. But, you know, it very much derived from everything I'd seen and heard and thinking, okay, so if this is what the trend is, what is my response to that trend? You know, do I want to adapt to it, which was perfectly feasible? Do I want to try to change it? Do I want to get out of it? So, you know, a great deal of my writing is about taking responsibility and accountability for the things you see and experience. And I think that's as true in my personal life as in my organizational life.
That's fascinating. You've written a fantastic book called Uncharted, How to Map the Future Together. And when the book was published in February 2020, I'm sure that, of course, that you wrote the manuscript a lot earlier. The novel coronavirus pandemic had not yet closed down much of the world. However, that happened quite not long after. And within the first days of 2021, we've really had our share of global chaos already, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And you write at the beginning of the book that accepting that the future is unknowable is where action begins. And I think that as we've been navigating 2020, I've seen kind of a difference between people who have been talking about longing for things to become normal or to become predictable in some ways again, and for the people who have more embraced, in a sense, the uncertainty. And I wanted to ask you, why do you think that it is so important that we accept that the future is unknowable? And how can we avoid maybe that hoping and waiting for things to become less volatile and more predictable?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think, you know, to a large degree, it's really sort of about childhood versus adulthood, right? Which is, if you just sit and wait and hope everything will turn out okay, essentially what you're doing is you're treating yourself a bit as a child, and you're effectively handing over what happens next to other people, many of whom you don't know, can't see, and may not at all have your interests at heart. Now, it doesn't follow from that, sadly, that if you take a more adult approach and decide, well, this is my life and I want to decide what happens to it, it doesn't follow that everything that you attempt will be successful. But it means you're engaged in your own life. You're not just a passenger in somebody else's bus. And so I think that the simple fact that the future is unpredictable doesn't mean we can't do anything. It means we have to be more alert to what's happening around us and more thoughtful about how we wish to respond to that. And I mean, it's interesting because I just finished a three-part blog post series today about the problems with power. And I think that, you know, I'm quite I've always been very uncomfortable with the vocabulary around leadership, not least because having grown up in Europe, you know, when I think of leadership, I translate it into Italian, which is Duce, or German, which is Führer. And neither of these has very nice connotations. And I find it kind of impossible in my head to separate those words. But I think, you know, it's very striking to me that we've seen this kind of growing obsession with leadership pretty much from the 1770s till now, which strikingly, at least in the US, is a period of rising inequality, economic inequality. And that's true generally. Well, it's generally true. The dates don't perfectly map, but it's also true in the UK. And I guess, you know, what I feel is the more passive we are in the face of an unpredictable future, the more we end up handing over to leaders who have over time accrued more and more power to themselves, and then kind of complaining when we don't like what they do with it. And so I think, you know, as adults, we have a responsibility to be active in our own life and to, if you like, put our shoulder in the direction of travel that we most want to see. Now, as I said, there aren't any guarantees about that, but there is a guarantee that if you're passive, you will go where someone or other people want you to go. So I think it's an existential question, right? Is it your life? Or are you happy to kind of outsource it to others? And I think in the very traumatic events that we've seen over the last 9 months, we can see that the cost of handing over our lives to others who don't have our best interests at heart can be very, very, very high indeed.
And I'm thinking we're also entrusting it to people who might not, I mean, they're also just guessing. They're also just kind of trying to understand. And I'm thinking connected to that, if we think that we want to not be passive, but we want to be active, and then a part of that is, of course, we want to try to predict, we want to try to anticipate and understand what is coming up, what is happening. And you've talked or written about the problem with the way that we predict and try to anticipate the future. For example, that one of the problems is that we think that history will repeat itself, and you've given a number of great examples. And I really encourage people to read your book and get those. But what would you say are helpful ways for leaders to think about predicting and anticipating the future? And what are the pitfalls that we should really try to avoid?
Well, I think the first thing is to understand that the future is inherently unpredictable. It's highly driven by new knowledge, which in itself we obviously don't have, because then it wouldn't be new knowledge. And to get away, therefore, from thinking that somebody out there, some guru, some pundit, some think tank has the answer. What the experts in forecasting who study forecasting will tell you is that if you're very, very rigorous, you consult a very broad range of sources, you routinely adjust your predictions and are always assigning and adjusting probabilities to them, then probably the furthest out you can see with any degree of accuracy is 400 days. If you aren't that rigorous, and most of us aren't, then probably the furthest out you can do, if you do kind of casual forecasting, is maybe 150 days. And even then, there will be things like epidemics, which are inherently unpredictable. So what that means is that nobody knows. Nobody knows. And, you know, part of my book was inspired by conversations I had with people where they would say, what's going to happen about Brexit? What's going to happen? You know, is Trump going to get elected to the presidency? And I kept thinking, why are people asking me? I don't know. We've never had a candidate like Trump before. How do we know? Right? We've never had a referendum like Brexit before. How do we know? We don't know. And yeah, people can, you know, of course, pollsters, and there are some good pollsters out there, you know, do a lot of sampling and they're very careful about it. But even they, of course, are wrong from time to time. And we're very angry with them when they're wrong, because we somehow think they ought to know. But the fault is ours in the sense that we have not accepted the inherent complexity of life. And when they, you know, in complex systems, there's a huge amount of ambiguity and unpredictability. It's why, you know, the Bank of England will say there will be financial crashes in the future, but we don't know when or why or what will provoke it. It's why epidemiologists have known for decades that there will always be epidemics. But because every single one is different, we can't predict when they'll break out, where they'll break out, or what the pathogen will be. So I think, you know, we have to understand that this is not people doing their jobs badly. This is inherent in the world that we live in. And as a consequence, we have to think much more carefully about how prepared are we for things that could happen. And how adaptive are we as individuals or as organizations so that when we finally can see what's happening, we can move very quickly. And this is what Richard Hatchett, the director of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness, talks about just-in-time and just-in-case thinking. Just-in-time is about the ability to move very quickly. Just in case thinking is saying, okay, let's look at some of the reasonable, probable threats with very, very high impact and invest in protecting against those, not because we know they're going to happen, but just in case they happen, because if we are not prepared, the cost will be immense. And of course, no sooner had I written that, then we saw that played out in action. Now, almost all developed economies, I would hesitate to think of one that doesn't, operate with a, you know, trying to maximize efficiency. Efficiency has been the dominant managerial principle since the Industrial Revolution. But the problem with efficiency in a complex world that is inherently unpredictable is the efficiency strips out all your margin for error and surprise. And so around the world, we've seen healthcare systems that can't cope, aren't coping, because they were run with very narrow margins, which after the financial crisis, many of them were absolutely cut to the bone. It's certainly the case here in the UK, and I would argue that in the United States, you know, we see a healthcare system that really is not fit for the 20th century, never mind the 21st century, certainly not in a democracy. But it was much more efficient to leave that to the market, or so people thought, completely kind of denying the fact that epidemic threats have always been there. So I think what all of this means is that once you accept unpredictability, you have to start thinking about two things. One is, where is efficiency specifically dangerous for us? And let's start thinking about how we make those places or institutions more robust. And the second thing is, instead of looking for one simple narrative that tells us what's going to happen with a confidence that's frankly implausible, let's think about what the possible futures might be. What are the multiple scenarios based on reliable, solid data that could be what the future looks like? And, you know, I'm doing some work next week for the Singapore Scenarios Unit. And one of the reasons I have so much respect for their work is because they're always looking at what could happen. What are the different scenarios that are perfectly feasible, rational, explainable, looking 10, 20 years in the future? And the fact that there are multiple scenarios represents uncertainty. It represents the fact that we don't know. So it keeps minds kind of open to what is it we're seeing and what are those signals telling us.
I think a great example of that was a podcast and an article that I read early on. I think it was around the 20th of March,
where the author was, they had been looking into the situation, and they were saying that a lot of people have thought that this was, and they were making kind of comparisons with weather, and they said many people have thought this was a blizzard, but now more and more we're starting to talk about that it's a winter, but we don't think that it's a winter, we think it's a small ice age. And then they gave an example of a time when suddenly the world grew colder for a couple of days and the impacts. And they said that we think every organization needs to prepare for a scenario where you will only be able to meet with a maximum 10 people at, for the coming 2-3 years. Mm. Maybe it's not all the time, but it will happen at a different point. Mm. And then they said as well that if that doesn't happen, then you know exactly what to do. So you're not losing anything right. to prepare for, to set a strategy for a scenario like that. And that was actually really, really helpful to me and to us. And I'm thinking, what is maybe hindering us from thinking in that way? Mm. Is it that we do not want to think of the reality of a certain future, of a certain person getting elected, or a certain situation, or a certain financial crash, or,
So it's certainly the case that we don't want to think about negative outcomes, and that's what my book, Willful Blindness, is about, you know, from beginning to end, really, as to why we don't look at and don't see things that we don't want to see. But so I think it's partly that. It's partly the feeling that, if we think about these negative possibilities and what we would have to do to prepare for them, it looks expensive. And that means it's not efficient because there's not a guaranteed ROI. So that becomes a very rigid form of thinking, which means that, well, it's not a priority. But I think there's another thing too here. There's a chapter in my book called Think Like an Artist, which is really looking at the sensibility and creativity of artists and the fact that artists are routinely ahead of the game. You know, they are trendsetters. They are, you know, avant-garde. That's what it means, right? Ahead of the pack. And how they do that is both through kind of sensing, noticing what's happening around them, but it's also an imaginative capacity to weave this into something. And I think there's a great deal about the way that we run both our education systems and definitely the way that we run organizations, which specifically discourages or in fact disables creative thinking. And I encountered this with a number of companies I work with who asked me to come in and talk to their people, their leadership teams or whoever. So, you know, we want more innovation. We need more creativity. Tell us how to make our people more creative. And the honest truth is, you know, they started life creative. And many of them even fought their way through the education system and remained creative. But there's a huge amount about the way that we manage people that stops them being creative. I mean, once you have job descriptions and rules and regulations and KPIs and targets and all that kind of thing, you have specifically stopped people being creative. And we call this management, but it's very focused on stopping bad things happening much more than it is focused on ensuring that a lot of creative, imaginative work emerges. So, you know, generally in those situations, what I do is, first of all, let's look at how much of your management can you actually throw out. Right. Most people don't like it. It's desperately boring. It's fantastically expensive to administer. And there's a beautiful story in my book, which illustrates what I'm talking about. So it's about the Dutch healthcare system, which is significantly dependent on neighborhood nursing. The Dutch are very keen to get people out of hospitals because hospitals are very expensive. They're very infectious. And we know from tons of research, people get better at home. Food's better, you know, the environment's safer. It's psychologically more sustaining for most people. Yeah. So the whole of the Dutch healthcare system, you know, depends on this. And they had developed a bureaucracy for delivering neighborhood nurses to patients that was, I think, very recognizable as kind of standard 20th century industrialization. So you know, a client would trigger a process, which triggered a contract, which triggered the assignment of a nurse, which triggered a schedule. The contract would determine the level of service, and, you know, it was all barcoded and so on. And then the nurse would be assigned and be told, you know, go and visit on Monday for 7 minutes and Wednesday for 10 minutes and Friday for 12 minutes. This is a gigantic bureaucracy, which is essentially predicting what the patient needs and how to deliver it. And the consequences of this system were twofold. One is the nurses hated it. And the second one, as did the patients, and the second one is it was fantastically expensive to run because it's a huge bureaucracy. So one of the nurses who had trained in a former life as an economist was very sensitive to how obnoxious and onerous this was and said, well, let's try something different. Let's have teams of nurses and assign to them batches of patients. And then let's just tell them to do what they think is the right thing. Go as often as they want, stay as long as they want, do whatever they think is right for the patient. And the upshot of this experiment was that the cost of delivering neighborhood nursing fell by 30%. And that was because the patients got better in half the time. So essentially, when nurses no longer were expected to do what they were told, but were trusted to use their professional expertise, the outcomes were both better for patients and came in at a lower cost. Now, this is not the kind of reinvention that you could just figure out by sitting at a desk or a spreadsheet. You wouldn't come to this conclusion that it was even doable unless you tried it. So, you know, a great deal of creativity is about starting before you have all the data, right? And saying, well, I don't know what this painting is going to look like. How could I possibly know what it's going to look like until I start painting? But there's so much in the way that we run things, run life, run organizations, that wants guarantees before you start. And that specifically puts a brake on creative thinking and creative learning. And I think that, you know, part of what's so interesting about scenario planning is that it draws on people's creativity to see how do different systems work together. But it's also very striking, and I've seen this, that you can bring groups of executives together and give them a whole bunch of perfectly solid data for a scenario, and they literally cannot think about it, which is if it challenges their most sort of received wisdom, they simply cannot think about it. And they do go into denial, and they can't even play with it as an idea because they haven't played for decades. So I think there's just a great deal about our corporate cultures that militates against creativity, which militates against seeing potential futures, some of them daunting and some of them very optimistic. But if you can't play freely in your mind with the building blocks of this, then of course you're going to crave somebody else's certainty.
And I'm thinking that, I mean, looking at the culture behind that, and I've seen some examples where companies have kind of turned this on the head and where you had a culture where you would say that these are the decision makers and these are the executors.
Yeah.
And then of course the executors are not empowered to make decisions. And I think a part of why we experience so much terrible customer service is that the people that we meet are not empowered to actually help us.
Yeah.
And but it's somewhere, somebody somewhere else, and normally they can't be called or even emailed.
That's right.
And so nobody can actually make a decision for me.
Yeah.
And what would you say are, if you would just say something that that you would encourage organizations to think about as to change that culture to start that journey?
Well, I think it's very interesting. One of the things that we've seen in the pandemic is that managers have been forced to trust their frontline workers much more. And in general, they have not been disappointed because these people have a lot of expertise. They are the people who hear the complaints every day. They do know what's wrong with your products. And if you give them some latitude, some, you know, sort of freedom to make decisions, you know, up to a certain cost or up to a certain amount of time or whatever, by and large, they're going to make much, much better decisions than people who are miles and miles away from the action. And, you know, I've been pretty horrified, to be honest, by the appetite either to outsource this sort of work in order to basically reduce labor costs or to employ people on an extremely casual labor basis, so part of the gig economy, it basically implying, well, it doesn't really matter. You know, and the truth of the matter is listening to your customers is where all the information you need for innovation is to be found, right? Your customers know what's wrong with their products if you would only listen to them. And I remember I've written quite often about an American company that started around the year 2000 called Method. They make home care cleaning products. Yeah. And their chief product officer used to sit next to the customer service rep in their office because he just wanted to be able to overhear, what are people calling about? What are the problems that they're having? What are the concerns that they're having? What is it they don't understand about the product or don't like about the product? You know, it was absolutely a brilliant move. Had he stuck himself up in the executive suite somewhere, he would have known less and less as the years go by. When we casualize this kind of work, we hire people who have no incentive at all to think about what they're hearing or to care what the outcome is, except to the degree that maybe they're measured on it. So we have the many of the sources for creative thinking that we simply throw away. And I think we do that because we think, well, it's kind of low level, therefore not important. It is the most important thing. I mean, quite frankly, you know, the customers on the other end of that phone, they're the people paying your salary. And you don't want to listen to them? Or you want to palm them off to somebody you don't know and that you don't care enough to pay well enough? That's, you know, that's the core asset of your business, is that information. And most companies waste it.
That's so important. And we're going to shift the focus a little bit. And we started talking before a bit about willful blindness. Mm-hmm. And during season two, during the autumn last year, I've had a number of conversations with professors like Anton Brunsell, Mary Gentile, and Max Baserman, and as well as current and former chief ethics officers at Volkswagen and Telia, about corporations that have navigated corporate scandal due to unethical behavior. And I think it is connected to the conversations that we had. It's just in a bit different way. But as you look at these examples, it almost always becomes clear that there are people that could have seen, that should have noticed what was going on, but who chose either to look away or to just not say anything. It might even be whole industries. Mm-hmm. And you've written, as we said, a book about this called Willful Blindness. Mm-hmm. And could you just share one story that helps us understand what that willful blindness is and how it can be so insidious that it's there, but still we don't see it?
Yeah. So I wrote the book. It was in, I guess, about 2010. And it was very much inspired by the financial crisis when there was a lot of narrative saying, oh, we could never have seen this coming. And thinking, well, that's ridiculous. Lots of people saw it coming. They're in print from 2005 saying they can see this coming. But at the same time that I was having that thought, you know, it triggered lots of other thoughts. It triggered thoughts about, as it were, good Germans in the Third Reich, in the Second World War, you know, who claim not to have known anything about the Holocaust. It triggered thoughts about communities in Ireland who kind of knew you don't want to send your kids to that priest for his confirmation letter lessons. And I suddenly thought, wow, this sort of knowing and not knowing, there's quite a lot of that around. And what I discovered in the course of researching the book is that really, in almost all major failings of this kind. Not every single one, but most. I mean, there were definitely some I investigated and ruled out. But in most cases, the narrative always goes like this. Something goes wrong. Volkswagen is a classic case. At first, everybody says, oh, we couldn't possibly have known. Then they say it's a few bad apples. Then it turns out that quite a lot of people knew. And then it turns out kind of everybody knew or could have known. And so the question is not, you know, who can we throw out and punish publicly? The question is, how did it happen that a lot of people knew and nobody said anything? And this is a, you know, this is rarely about bad people. It's typically about bad systems. So it's not safe to speak up. I won't get my bonus. My boss won't like me. I don't know who to talk to. Everybody else isn't worried. So maybe I've got the wrong end of the stick. If I do speak up, you know, I'll be considered an idiot. And so there are huge psychological, social, often financial forces at work, which literally stop people from seeing what is in front of their eyes. In addition, if you work people very, very long hours, they develop tunnel vision, which means they will focus only on what they have got to know. And other things may be happening, but they quite literally will not see it. So, you know, one of the big mistakes many organizations make is to think that, well, if you can work 40 hours a week, you can work 50. And if you can work 50, you can work 60. And of course, many organizations think that's heroic. It's a sign of loyalty and commitment. And the truth is, you know, we've been doing productivity experiments since 1888. They all come back with the same results. Human beings have not changed. After about 40 hours a week, you get tired. When you get tired, you make mistakes. And part of the mistakes that you start to make is you just don't see things. So this narrative, you can see it in the banking crisis. You could see it in things like Deepwater Horizon. You could see it, as you said, in Volkswagen. You could see it in the mis-selling at Wells Fargo. You could see it in the transmission problem with General Motors. You could see it in the tragedy in the UK to do with Grenfell Tower, and also with the sexual abuse of children. I mean, it's all over the place. And I would argue, if I even need to argue, it was absolutely clear in our failure to prepare for any kind of epidemic, because we didn't want to think about it. It was going to involve unnecessary expense. So we just pretended it wasn't happening. The UK even was commended for its epidemic preparedness. But actually, when you look into what they'd actually done as opposed to what they'd written about, it's paper thin. And that's because there are no rewards for doing it in politics. I'm going to do something that might never be used. Nobody gets, you know, medals for that. So willful blindness is absolutely endemic to much in our organizational life. I don't think it can ever be eliminated. I think it can be reduced. And I love Mary Gentile's work because I think it's quite a powerful antidote against it. I think what has sprung up since then has been a belief that, okay, well, if nobody's speaking up, it's because they're afraid. And that's one reason, but it's not the only reason. And therefore, what we have to do is we have to tell people it's safe. And there's several problems with this. One is telling people it's safe does not make them feel safe. They've rarely worked in organizations where it was obviously safe, so they don't believe you. And the second thing is, even in organizations where it is safe and it is visibly safe, organizations don't exist in a vacuum. If you're running an organization in a country that has high levels of unemployment, where people may carry very large amounts of personal debt, like mortgages, trust me, those people don't feel safe. It doesn't matter what you say. The context is dangerous. So I think this puts a huge responsibility on managers at all levels to understand how susceptible they are to willful blindness, how unlikely it is that people will tell them about problems, and therefore how hard they have to work to ensure that that kind of information comes to light. But I think your working assumption has got to be, on the whole, people are not telling you everything you need to know.
One of the issues that I've seen, and I would love to hear your perspective on that when it comes to this willful blindness and these issues with unethical behavior and unhealthy cultures and all of it. And I'm thinking about a tech conference that I was visiting about 8 years ago. And I remember how people were so kind of elated about the possibilities and how if we would just be more, or as we were more connected, as we had access to more information, the world would be better. And actually, there were thoughts of that now the world would become good in a sense. Mm. And I just thought, human nature in that sense, to me, hasn't changed. I mean, we still have a propensity for both great things and also for quite a lot of evil. And I'm thinking that as organizations, one of the problems that we have is that we're so driven by how we are going to market ourselves. And so that becomes the narrative of our organization. When we work on our values, we do it because we want people to think that we are a great or a good organization. And I think that's kind of comes to one of the key issues, key parts of the problems. And so what I'm encouraging organizations to do instead is to admit that yes, we are great in many ways, but we're also broken in others. And I'm just thinking that if we would have that type of mindset, we would actually be more willing to look for that brokenness, because we would actually assume that it exists, just like an IT professional will assume that, or a good IT professional will assume that a system can be breached. Mm-hmm. In the same way, we need to think of our organizations. What are your thoughts about that? And how do you think that we could get that type of thinking, if that's what we need?
Yeah. Well, I think you're absolutely right, and your analogy is a good one. I remember having a conversation with Christine Lagarde one time when she said, well, since culture is such a problem, shouldn't we approach it like we would an IT system and think about, how could I break this? How can I do the wrong thing? Because that's really, that's the ultimate stress test, right? If I can't hack into your system, it's probably secure, but I need to find really good hackers, right, to be very confident. So I agree with you. I mean, I think that we have to assume that willful blindness is endemic to organizations. I think we have to assume that power changes the way that people think. And so there's a real problem about giving people power and expecting them not to change. I think there's a real problem with hierarchies, which are almost designed to produce pleasers, because individuals understand that my way up this ladder is to please the person ahead of me. And I think the minute somebody says, no, I don't think power is a problem, or I don't think hierarchy is a problem, or I don't think we have any willful blindness here, I think, oh, yikes, now we are in trouble. So I think you're right. And I think, I think we equally have to cut people some slack, which is not to expect them to be perfect, but to create a culture in which being imperfect is okay as long as it's not with bad intent. And this is, of course, famously what the airline industry did. When it had accidents where when they investigated them, they could see that the accidents had been caused by a lot of very minor errors that everybody knew about and hadn't spoken about. And those taught them that it's no good throwing out somebody or punishing somebody. What you have to do is create an environment in which everybody can put their hand up and say, I don't know if this is a problem, but this looks odd to me. Or every time I do this, it doesn't quite work the way it's supposed to do. And that where these small things are understood to have a very big impact. Yeah, I mean, I sometimes think, when I think back to my time as a CEO, I think my kind of working assumption was, well, there's something going wrong somewhere, and it's my job to figure out where and how. And it's not to find scapegoats. It's just to keep, you know, scanning the horizon and talking to people at every level of the organization to see, you know, where are these early warning signs that something's not quite right. And instead, I think what we tend to do is, A, we do look for people to throw out so we feel powerful and like we're doing something. But I think we also tend, because we're so focused on all the kind of so-called scientific management of managing people by results, we pay a lot less attention to how they get those results and the consequences of how they do their work.
So as we're in the beginning of this year, and I'm just thinking, as if you would want to reimagine for a second what you think needs to change of how we think about our organizations, how we think about leadership. Of course, that's a huge question, but just some key things that you would encourage our listeners to think about in terms of their organization to prevent willful blindness, to be better at anticipating the future, to be better at also, I mean, at serving the people that we're actually here to serve.
It's interesting because, of course, you know, we're starting to talk a lot in the context of climate change about environmental regeneration and sustainability. And I think much of that conversation has a direct parallel with organizational life. I think we need to think about how healthy are our organizations and how healthy are the people in them, both to do with physical health, imaginative health, creative health, financial health, as well as environmental impact. You know, is a good place to work a place where I grow and have fun? Or is it a place where, you know, if I do what I'm told in a hierarchy, which is inherently threatening, you know, I get brownie points for surviving, in essence. So I think, you know, I've been thinking about this obvious in the context of the pandemic, where I think many companies have suddenly awoken, you know, in a very positive way to the notion that actually if they don't look after their people, they don't have a business. You know, that actually the mental health and the physical health of their people now matters a very great deal. And I, you know, what I hope is that everyone's learning from that, that actually the health of the people and the health of the organization are inextricably linked. And to the degree that you burn people out, to the degree that the management structure or culture is inherently intimidating, you will not have healthy people, you will not have a healthy business. And what you won't do is regenerate the people in it or the economy that you're contributing to. You'll just be doing what we have done, what, you know, in the last 100 years, which is extracting and destroying. And we now can see that this is not sustainable. And it isn't sustainable in terms of the environment, but it isn't sustainable in terms of businesses if we aren't going to continue to grow and develop and enhance the creative and intellectual capacity of every single person that we work with. And we have to stop thinking about extractive leadership. And I think start thinking about how we create really healthy workplaces in every sense of the word.
I love that. And here in this podcast, we talk a lot about or think about heart-healthy organizations, to think using the thought or the picture of the heart where we can actually look very fit and successful on the outside, but still there might be things that along the way are going to take us down, or they're going to have a negative impact on the people around us. So I think that that is such a great encouragement as we step into this new year to think about the health of really every aspect of our organizations. It is financial health, yes, but it is also so much more. And at the end of the day, that will contribute to the financial health.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think the pandemic has really shown people how interconnected all of these things are. And I just hope they don't forget, because we've paid a high price for that learning.
And just connected to that, what can we do? Because I think that we so easily go back to our last kind of known setting, in a sense. And what can we do to be intentional about not going back, about not kind of losing the lessons that we have been learning, or at least have been forced into in this last year?
Yeah. Well, I would say, I'm seeing kind of two different kinds of companies. I'm seeing companies that moved to remote working pretty quickly and then sort of thought, thank goodness that's over, and just, well, now we just wait it out. And they're very nostalgic, thinking back, to business as usual. And I think they're quite sad places because people actually quite like working from home. The notion that this might end one day does not make their heart sing. There's a second group of companies who, having moved everybody to remote working and having discovered, wow, when we give people trust, they repay that trust, is now thinking, okay, so this narrative that people aren't very good at change, it's not true. It's only true when people don't know what the change is for, why the change is happening, or when people lie about why the change is happening. So if people are really good at change, what else do we want to change? And let's do it now. Let's not wait. And so there's a whole bunch of companies I work with now that have accelerated huge amounts of change because they're in a place at a time where people are definitely up for this. And they like the idea of not going back to work, but going forward to work, that work that works in a healthier way, in a way that where they have more freedom, where they have more flexibility, where they have more creative input in their lives and in their companies, and where a lot of the kind of old distrusting management techniques are gone. So I think there's momentum there for the managements that are bold enough to see it and feel it and just keep going. And I think those organizations will come out of this period much healthier, with a lot more energy, and will really have captured the loyalty and enthusiasm of their people. I would say the same thing is true with regard to how companies are changing in response to the climate crisis. I would say the same thing is true with regard to how companies are finally responding to crises of inequality, specifically ethnic inequality. And I think that, in some companies, there's real enthusiasm about, okay, if everything's changing, let's go with it. Let's stop trying to hold back. Let's stop thinking the old status quo was okay, because now actually we can see it wasn't. I mean, the very simple fact that for at least 20 years, since we could have worked from home, most companies haven't let people do that, because they were afraid that they were slackers. And they've discovered actually quite the opposite. I think we are realizing this enormous unfulfilled human potential in our organizations, which comes from seeing people as part of a machine rather than the bringers of creativity, insight, and wisdom. And if we can start seeing people truly as assets, of having huge value, of having actually the only irreplaceable value in a company, then we're going to be doing, I think, better work in a better way.
That's amazing, Margaret. And I'm so grateful that you took the time for this conversation. And I would really encourage everyone to go in and get Margaret's books and also watch her TED Talks. They're just really fantastic conversations that I think are also really helpful to just bring to your leadership team or to your HR and compliance team and to have conversations about. And Margaret, what are other ways that you would encourage people to connect with you and follow your work?
Well, you can see some of my work on my website, which is www.mheffernan.com. I publish a blog a week on medium.com. Those are the best places to find me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, It really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we've received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.